Hello, this is Tim Reedy for America Magazine, and we're pleased to have joined with us today Father Daniel Grudy of the Center for Latino Spirituality and Culture at the University of Notre Dame. He's also an associate professor of theology. Welcome, Father Dan.
Thanks, Tim.
You just went on a trip where you saw some of the effects of the Syrian refugee crisis. You wrote about it for America in our November 26th issue. Maybe you can describe that trip and how it came about.
Sure. It was a part of a delegation that went on behalf of the U.S. Bishops Conference, and we traveled to look at the Syrian refugee situation. So we first went to Egypt, and then went to Lebanon, and then went to Jordan, and then finally went to Turkey. So we went to a number of the bordering countries around Syria, and we were trying to really assess the refugee situation there. So foremost among them would have been the people leaving Syria. But in the process, we also kind of came across a number of other groups as well, particularly people being trafficked in the Sinai Peninsula, and as well as those who are fleeing Iran, coming into neighboring countries because of religious persecution, but also those who are still fleeing Iraq because of the situation there. Many of them have fled from Iraq into Syria and then have said fled from Syria to other parts, you know, because of the deteriorating situation there. So it was, you know, really a perspective on the humanitarian crisis going on there, and particularly the church's response to it.
Now I'm just going to give some numbers. You cite in your article that Syrians fleeing the country, the conflict there, could reach 700,000 by year's end and 1.5 million by June 2013. So we're talking about huge numbers here.
Right. That's correct. And currently there's probably about 100,000 in Egypt, probably about 200,000 in Jordan, about 100,000 in Turkey, and about 100,000 in Lebanon. And so these numbers continue to grow exponentially. So there are different ways in which the situation in Syria, just as it continues to unravel, there are a number of groups that are fleeing. So that this could become, you know, up to the numbers you mentioned by the end of the year, and certainly by the next summer, you know, it could be twice that many.
Maybe you can just describe what you encountered for us. These are makeshift camps with women, children, living, obviously, in very difficult circumstances.
Right. There's a couple different responses. So, obviously, one of the things that did impress us was the concerted effort that the governments in each of those countries are trying to do in response to the situation there. The churches, the mosques, other humanitarian organizations are also trying to respond. But even with all of those efforts, it's just barely scratching the surface in terms of what needs to be done. So in terms of the Lebanese situations, we have people coming over the hillsides in many cases, so trying to just find protection in that area. But the Lebanese government does not want to create another Palestinian situation, and so they do not have any official camps per se. The Jordan situation does have camps, and those are sponsored by the United Nations, so the United Nations agency in charge of that, so UNHCR. And the Turkish government has a different model, which is they want to do it by themselves, but they want the help and the resources from the international community to do so. So they do not partner per se with UNHCR. They do kind of work with them in some consultative role, but primarily they want to do it themselves. And in many ways, they've exceeded international standards in Turkey in terms of what's happening in those camps, but still it's not an ideal situation. Even in the best situation in those camps, it's still a very difficult place to live. So there are many that are living in camps. Some of them are kind of resettling with relatives as they can, or people they know in the neighboring countries. And others are just kind of slipping through the cracks and going anywhere they possibly can. So right now, most of the camps are women and children. But in the camps we went to, we saw a number of people who had just come off the battlefield. Some of them are presumably are part of rebel forces as well in terms of the fighting. Others are caught in the crossfire and are wounded in the process. So different groups from the Moroccan government to the French government to the U.S. government, I think, are trying to pour in aid as they can. But as you said, the kind of the crisis is such, the numbers are such that it's kind of overwhelming the internal infrastructures of these countries. And currently they have not been able to get the amount of support that's needed to really address those problems.
Now, obviously, there are many reasons why people choose to flee, but what are some of the stories here in terms of why people? You mentioned that some of them have connections, perhaps, with the rebels who are fighting against the government and don't want to get caught in the crossfire, or perhaps have lost husbands or fathers in this battle and decided to pick up and leave. Maybe you could talk more about that.
Yeah, there are a lot of complicated vectors going through the Middle East. So our religious differences, the Sunnis, the Shiites, and other the Alawites, you know, and also the Christians that are kind of caught in the middle of the crossfire and all of this, and how those alliances connect with neighboring countries, you know, remains, you know, a very, very complicated process. So, but I think in terms of the narratives that really, to me, stood out, I remember we had went into this one camp in Lebanon, and it was just put together by makeshift plastic. These were not even officially registered refugees yet with UNHCR. So these folks were literally about a mile or two from the border. In that area, one of the first persons we met up with had been traveling for 3 days on foot. She had a bullet go through her mouth and then was lodged in her shoulder, and she still had not seen a doctor yet. So they came to the area where we were, and they were begging us for any kind of medical services because they had just killed her husband. The woman who had approached us, that they had just killed her husband as well. In the camp we went into, all three of the women there in their early 20s, all of their husbands were killed. And then a mother came in, and you know, she not only had lost her three sons, but she just found out that her grandson had been killed and that her fourth son was put in prison. So in the midst of this, a lot of the women in this situation, is women and children, these makeshift tents, you couldn't help but wonder really what kind of horizon they have. I mean, a lot of the women there don't have, you know, opportunities in the same ways as they do in the West, and many of them didn't have education. And so they really had lost a lot of the supports that they'd had for, you know, in terms of their husbands and their families. And so it's a case of just, what impressed me was, you know, just really intense vulnerability. And I think though I had seen economic migrants, though I'd seen political refugees, in this case they're really refugees from war. That couldn't help but leave you very stunned by the situation people were living in.
You mentioned the plight of Christians in particular. What's the particular dynamic in Syria?
Right. The Arab Spring has really opened up the doors to possible reforms, but I think our experience was that there was still a great deal of ambivalence about where this Arab Spring was going, because as was the case in Tunisia, certainly in Egypt, to some extent Libya, now Syria, there is a recognition that some of these strong dictators have also kind of kept in check some of these really traditional rivalries and antagonisms within the country itself. So as this kind of creates a void, what it does is it opens the way for extremists to come in. So in the case of Egypt, there's not really a clarity about where this Muslim Brotherhood government is going to go and what this means, you know, in turn for religious minorities like Christians. And so in Syria, as bad as Assad is, and right now he's killed about 35,000 people, so the war against his own people and the crisis there is, you know, unimaginable. But the Christians there had received previously some protection under his government. This is prior to the fighting. So subsequent to the fighting, it's another story, but prior to the fighting, they did receive some protections to worship, as they did in Iraq. But now that these governments are gone, then what happens is that these extremist groups, as they come in, target some of the Christian groups. Sometimes they see them as allied with the government because they received some kind of protections previously. But the net result is that there is increasing vulnerability of Christians in that region. Many of them are being pushed out of places like Iran, like Iraq, like Syria, and perhaps Egypt even. So what that means is diminishing numbers, and because of that, people are fleeing. And in the places that is traditionally the Holy Land, we see fewer and fewer Christians.
Now, you mentioned the situation in Iraq. This seems like a very familiar story after what went on in Iraq and all the refugees that went to Jordan and other places. What can we learn from that story in terms of, you know, what happens to these refugees? What is their long-term prospects? Are they resettled? What happens to them?
Right. I think this is, you know, part of the work of the delegation as well, because right now the United States resettles more refugees than any other country in the world. And within the United States, the U.S. Bishops' Conference resettled more refugees than any other organization. So in that point, that there's the U.S. bishops resettle more refugees than anybody anywhere. And so one area of increasing concern has been to really deal with issues of those Iraqi refugees who've really fled the conditions under the war and gone into neighboring countries. But I think what is of a concern because of the delegation, some of the findings and other sources that are giving insight into this, is that the people who have been fleeing from Iraq into Syria now are having to flee from Syria into other places. Some of the neighboring countries won't accept them, or they won't accept them unless they go back to Iraq. And so, really, I think there is an increasing plea from some humanitarian groups, including faith-based groups, to really try to provide some space for groups like them to find resettlement elsewhere. We had talked with a group of three Iraqi refugees that, you know, had left when they were 16. They're now kind of in their mid-20s, and so really literally for the last 10 years of their life, they've been just trying to seek some place of safety, of protection, yet alone on the horizon opportunity. But I couldn't help but think, you know, if we took out the year 16 to 25, you know, I know from my own life or people that I know, it's a very, very formative years to really take that section of your life out of education, training, development, opportunities, and to just find yourself on the move, on the run, trying to find protection, safety, shelter. It's a very different scenario. And so people, many of them are just kind of not only caught in the crossfire, but often finding themselves with closed doors no matter where they look.
Maybe you could talk more about the humanitarian response to these refugees. You mentioned that the church is involved. There are other religious groups involved. The UN is involved, of course. But as you write in your piece, the response thus far has not been nearly sufficient. What do we need? You know, what's the next step to actually address this crisis in a way that would be would really do some good?
Yeah, I mean, I think that part of the work of the delegation as well is to bring a bit more consciousness to this issue. I mean, I think there is an increasing awareness about what's going on in Syria in terms of how we respond to this, both in terms of government and also in terms of faith-based groups. It's kind of increasing significance. But certainly when, from faith-based groups, really when you get down to the real core of it, you see the human suffering going on. And I think when you really are confronted with that, you can't help but say, you know, that things are not complicated at all. The politics are extremely complicated in this region, but the humanitarian struggles are not complicated. It's very obvious what's happening there. And so, really, the faith-based groups, it's interesting to see how the church is really there on the front lines, and they're not just serving other Christians. They're serving any human being in need. I know in one Catholic organization we were with, I mean, there's a very interesting sign that said, you know, being Syrian does not make you our client, but being extremely vulnerable does. And so there's a lot of respect even from the Muslim communities in terms of what the church is doing there. But at the same time, the context is it's very difficult to be a Christian in these environments, because even to, if someone does want to change from Muslim religion to Christian religion or to Catholicism, it's illegal. So how the church lives out its mission in those areas is, you know, is a complicated endeavor. But as you mentioned, you know, what are some of the next things that can be done? Well, governments, I think, need to be involved. And I think there are ways in which, say, governments are supporting the refugee effort by supporting agencies like the United Nations High Commission for Refugee. So the High Commissioner for Refugee there really is in charge of setting up the refugee camps there. In a case like Jordan, a lot of the monies are given to the UN to respond to this issue. In Turkey, I found it much more complex, you know, meeting with some of the authorities there, that there was sort of, I was deeply impressed by the amount of things that they were trying to do. But what left me much more ambivalent, and in some sense left me really with a question about how it will unfold, is Turkey wants to provide the support to the refugees, and they want the money from the international community, but I don't see that they want to set up the collaborative structures internationally that are necessary for it to be a joint effort. So, in other words, sort of like, give us the money and we'll take care of the refugees. And I don't think that's going to work. Frankly, I think that unless there's some sort of shared responsibility, as there are shared resources, it's probably not going to work. And that's, Turkey's going to be a major focal point in terms of where a lot of these refugees end up. And as the numbers increase, the ability to provide protections for these refugees is going to diminish. So a question we had throughout the delegation is, where's the breaking point? You see places like Jordan, where they have an influx of 200,000 people into their whole society of a country of, I'm not sure exactly, 6 million, I want to say. So it's a huge, huge amount of people coming in. They have to double up their school systems. It's a tremendous drain on the infrastructure. They willingly take it on. Surprisingly, they have a great sort of humanitarian ethic and a kind of, a, I think, a really generous response. But you have to ask, what's the breaking point? At what point will they say, this is too much, this actually destabilizes our whole region even, if this really increases?
Yeah, it seems like if they have not reached that point, it's fast approaching because, as you mentioned, it's not just Syria, it's Iraq, the whole region, people fleeing Egypt, it's really going to reshape, radically reshape the region for decades to come.
Right, and I think that's part of, you know, what the delegation really came back in its findings and saying, you know, this does affect everybody. And I think there is this humanitarian concern, but it also is something that can be tremendously destabilizing these regions. And the harder part is also knowing what the future shape of these governments are going to be. Because if you do get extremist groups in there, certainly in Syria and other places, that some of these anti-Assad supporters are al-Qaeda sort of affiliated groups. And so it's not simply the case that the next regime is going to be better. We hope so. Maybe over the long term it might be. But at this point, the forces that come together don't necessarily indicate that there are better, if you will, kind of political horizons, you know, on the setting. And in the meantime, you know, a lot of people are being caught in the crossfire. And so, I mean, I guess the issue that was highlighted for us again and again was the situation of the vulnerability of the people. And the winter's coming, that they do not have, you know, these very flimsy tents. There's really very few ways in which people can find heating even, and even having some of their basic needs for medical services met. It's a little better managed within the camps, and it's a little better managed, especially, I think, in Turkey in terms of some of the living conditions people were in. But it's not a permanent solution. At best, it's a stopgap measure. And the ideal thing was that people would be able to return to Syria, and hopefully someday that will be possible.
Now, UN, as you mentioned, is a part of a delegation with U.S. Conference of Bishops, Migration and Refugee Services. You're writing about this for us. You're talking about it. What are some of the goals, other goals of the delegation now that you're back? I mean, is lobbying the U.S. government one potential area of perhaps you could get some help there?
Right. Many of the people who went on the delegation, there were a core of five of us, and many of them are working in issues of policy. Many of them are working in the Bishops' Conference. And so there was a report done that's now on the Bishops' Conference website, and in that there are a listing of some of the recommendations that the delegation brought back. We had a series of meetings last week in Washington that really dealt with institutional actors that for which the Syrian refugee situation, you know, has some relevance and connection to them. There will be some meetings with the State Department as well as with the other members of Congress trying to kind of increase humanitarian aid, trying to increase awareness of what's going on and trying to sort of highlight, you know, some of the areas of vulnerability I think that were made known to us. So some of this I think they will have some awareness of, but there are other issues that may not have been as much on people's radar. I think another area of human vulnerability was the issues of human trafficking in the Sinai. So in the midst of some of the changes because of the Arab Spring, say within Egypt, there has been a weakened infrastructure in terms of police enforcement. And up in the northern, up in the Sinai Peninsula, you know, there kind of has paved the way for certain areas of lawlessness that smugglers have taken advantage of. So there are not a small number of people that are being trafficked out of Eritrea into Sudan, and then working in conjunction with police officials and Bedouin smugglers, they actually have trafficked people up into the Sinai Peninsula, where they kidnap, torture, and extort victims upwards up to $40,000. And so what they'll do is they'll torture victims on the phone as they call their relatives throughout Europe and U.S. and elsewhere, saying that, you know, as they're torturing, if you don't send us $40,000, we'll continue this even up to stealing the organs of the individuals, you know, at hand. So it's believed that the person's organs can be worth as much as $40,000 on the black market. And so what's happening is that there is trafficking of persons and trafficking of organs and sort of the exploiting and extortion of people coming out of these areas like Eritrea. So there's some documented cases on this, but it hasn't really reached quite the level of attention that I think is necessary. CNN did do a report on this. They captured quite well, I think, some of the issues and the dynamics there. But I think the delegation wants to bring issues like the smuggling, like the trafficking, like the unaccompanied minors, like the Iraqi ex-Syria refugees, as well as the very pressing issue of the current Syrian refugees to the attention of lawmakers, saying this is a humanitarian crisis, but this is also a very serious political crisis. that really has potential to destabilize this region. Because if when Syria goes, when Assad goes, this has really deep implications as well for countries like Lebanon, who are so interconnected with these countries. And so that level of tension and, I think, instability was made very clear to us while we were there.
Now, finally, I will recommend folks to read this article, but something that perhaps you can speak to end is the rich biblical allusions that you found on your trip. And for people of faith, Christians, people part of the Judeo-Christian tradition, the story of refugees is not an unfamiliar one to us. So maybe you could speak about that.
Yeah, so for me, as a theologian approaching this area, I was constantly kind of asking questions about the church's response to migrants, about the spirituality of the migrants, and about theological questions related to migration. And at one point, we had gone to Mount Nebo, which was on the Jordan side of the Jordan River. And so we ascended up to the top of this mountain, and at the end of the book of Deuteronomy, this is the last sight that Moses sees. And so Moses has a vision from the top of Mount Nebo of the land that was promised to Abraham, to Isaac, to Jacob, and his descendants. And so he gets a vision of this promised land. He never crosses the Jordan to enter it, but it is this view of really what the promise is about. So I couldn't help but survey that geography from there and look to the south and the Sinai and really think about this issue of trafficking in the Sinai, look to the north in terms of Lebanon and Turkey to see the Syrian refugee situation, look to the east, look to Iran and to Iraq in terms of religious persecution and religious minorities, look all around Jordan and see unaccompanied minors and other issues that we're facing them there with refugees. And really, the question with me is saying, you know, where is the promise in this area? I mean, how do we think about the promise here still? We're still the generation kind of waiting on this side of the Jordan, kind of trying to cross over. And yet, when we did see the groups out there, like Caritas, like CRS, like other groups that are really giving food to the hungry, reaching out to the vulnerable, providing medical services to those who are in distress, really to serving all people regardless of their creed, serving them because of need and not creed. You know, when you see this, you say this is ways in which the faith, community faith, is crossing this Jordan River and trying to find some sort of homeland or promised land where people's human dignity is realized. You know, I mean, it couldn't help coming back home with such a shift of consciousness, coming back onto the campus here at Notre Dame, really thinking, you know, what would it be like to have these people have the experience of really just growing up in an environment where they can be educated, where they can find what they need, where they can grow up as and have safety and protections and these various types of things. And so that to me remains the open question: is how do we help the human community really help all people find this promised land, and how do we find a place where people can have their rights respected and their needs met and their relationships develop in the way that God intends? But we're still a long way off. I mean, I guess the vision from the promised land is that the land that has refugees right now was always a land that had refugees. And yet it's not a new issue, but still every generation defines its moral worth in terms of how it responds to those who are vulnerable. And so I think in the end I was left humbly with the sense of saying that this is also the land into which God migrated. And that not only did he migrate into becoming human, into joining the human race, but he migrated into these parts as a refugee amidst the political crises of his day. So this flight into Egypt really is a continuing kind of, if you will, iconic manifestation of God's solidarity with the vulnerability. But I think I might just conclude, Tim, by just saying that, you know, I left here the United States really wanting to understand the refugee situation in the Middle East. And when I got there, you know, when I really tried to get a sense of the politics there at closer range, I really wanted to analyze it. But after entering into the tents and really speaking with the refugees and hearing their stories, I became more and more quiet. And yet after hearing their stories, I was speechless. I mean, I was just so affected by the level of struggle and suffering and vulnerability. But by the very end, I just felt broken open, and I just remember weeping, you know, on the situation. And what I felt in that was also kind of God's heart weeping for what people are going through. There's just no way that people should have to go through this kind of, you know, struggle and suffering and indignity and violence. And so I think the work of the church is continually to try to find some space, some healing, some service, some connection, some humanity that really helps people find a way to a new land. So it's something I think that claims us all on some fundamental level, and maybe it exposes the ultimate vulnerability that all human beings are exposed to. But I think all the more reason why we need to do whatever we can to help people who are living in that situation.
Well, Father Daniel Grudy, Associate Professor of Theology at Notre Dame, we want to thank you very much for providing us with this report, and we will continue to follow this.
Great, Tim. Thanks very much. It's great being with you.
Thank you.